She began her career as a microbiologist in 1990 and then transitioned to epidemiology in 1999, serving as an enteric epidemiologist, field epidemiology director, and director of surveillance and investigation. And during that time, she had led investigations of many infectious disease outbreaks and has served a key role in the 2009 influenza pandemic response. Since 2009, she has served as a state epidemiologist and the director of the Epidemiology Resource Center, overseeing programs including infectious disease epidemiology, vector-borne and zoonotic diseases, sexually transmitted disease epidemiology, the behavioral risk factor surveillance system, and public health geographics. She also serves as an agency spokesperson for infectious diseases, and she was the incident commander, as you probably remember, for the response to the first U.S. case of MERS in May 2014, and for the Indianapolis response to the HIV outbreak in Scott County, Indiana in 2015. She is an adjunct faculty member at the Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health and has been an active member of CSDE since 2010. She was a scholar in the 2010 National Public Health Leadership Institute and a fellow in the 2001 Mid-America Regional Public Health Leadership Institute. So with that, I'll invite you to come up.
Good morning, everyone. It is a pleasure and a privilege to be here with you today. And I certainly thank the conference organizers for inviting me to speak with you. My objective today is to tell a story. It's to tell a story of an example of what happens when the substance abuse epidemic intersects with infectious disease, as what happened in Scott County, Indiana in 2015. Scott County, Indiana lies within the southeastern portion of our state, about 30 miles north of Louisville along Interstate 65. It is a very small rural county of a population of about 24,000 people, and the town that was really the epicenter of the HIV outbreak that I will describe has about 4,200 residents. There are a lot of resource challenges in Scott County, which consistently ranks 92nd out of 92 counties in our state in many health and social indicators, including life expectancy, high school completion, poverty rates, and unemployment. What I'm going to share with you is really the ingredients that came together that underlies the outbreak that of HIV and hepatitis C co-infection, setting up the stage in an area that has some challenges with public health infrastructure, an increase in injection drug use, a large, very interconnected needle-sharing network of about 500 people, and multiple injections per day of an opioid painkiller oxymorphone. With one introduction that is presumed to be of a highly infectious individual who is HIV positive into that network that sparked an outbreak that to date has resulted in about 199 cases of HIV. In late 2014, this outbreak began to appear when three new diagnoses of HIV were identified in what is known as District 9, which are the counties that lie along the Ohio River in the southeastern crescent of Indiana. The disease intervention specialist who was assigned to investigate these cases, and I give a real shout out to the DIS who work every day in investigating these cases, because without these folks, we would not have known that this was even taking place, at least initially. The DIS had learned that two of these individuals had shared needles and had a common contact, needle-sharing contact, which led to increased contact tracing in this group. That led to the identification of eight more new infections in a jurisdiction that it had reported five new HIV cases within about 5 years. So there were some early indications right away that the numbers were very alarming. In addition, all of these cases were residents of Austin, this small town of about 4,200 people. All of the cases reported injection of the opioid analgesic oxymorphone, including the brand extended release of Opana. Our agency's HIV-STD division took the information, created some contact maps, and determined a cluster description and potential causes and risk factors that were underlying this outbreak, which eventually would become the largest HIV outbreak in Indiana and later on determined by CDC to be the largest HIV outbreak in the country related to injection drugs. Drug use among the HIV-positive cases included, the Opana ER brand name formulation, including the crush-resistant or abuse-deterrent formulation. It was reported among cases that multi-generational sharing of injection equipment was actually occurring. People in the same households, in the same families, with daily injections approaching anywhere from 4 to 15 injections per day, given the very short half-life of the drug and repeated doses needed to stave off the symptoms of withdrawal. As of June 9th, before I submitted the presentation, we had 198 confirmed cases of HIV that had been reported associated with this outbreak, and about 89% of the named contacts that had been linked to the outbreak cases had been located and offered testing. In addition, we had some individuals who'd been tested who turned out not to be related to the outbreak. The positivity rate among tested contacts for HIV was 39%, with the average amount of unique contacts per case being 8, ranging from 0 to 80. What is remarkable about this outbreak, and I believe Dan Church asked this question regarding hepatitis C, is the amount of co-infection among HIV cases is about 94%. So we do not have just an outbreak of HIV, but an outbreak essentially of hepatitis C as well. And this is the latest epidemic curve that shows the actual specimen collection dates of the first positive specimens that were tested among HIV cases. You can see that the initial cases were identified in late 2014, early 2015, with a large surge in cases there on the left side related to the increased testing efforts that were part of the response that were launched in March, April, and May. Since that time, we've held additional what we call testing blitzes or testing opportunities in the community that have resulted in a few additional cases being identified. But what is also remarkable about this is that the number of cases greatly declined after the response really was what was underway in Austin, and I will talk about that in more detail in a few minutes. Among cases, the median age was 34 years, ranging from 18 to 60 years, slightly more males than females, with 99% being non-Hispanic white, which reflects the overall demographics of the area. By far, the vast majority, 95% of our cases, admitted to injecting drugs, and a smaller percentage, 5.7%, admitted exchanging sex for drugs or money. As I mentioned earlier, the socioeconomic factors of the community really play a large role, and especially looking at the social determinants of health that underscore the substance abuse that lies at the root of the outbreak. Scott County has a very high poverty rate of about 19% of folks live at or below the poverty level, and a relatively high unemployment rate of about 9%. Almost a little over 1 in 5 individuals do not complete high school, and there is a very high proportion of individuals in the county that do not have medical insurance, health insurance, and do not have medical care access. There is one health care provider in Austin, and the nearest health care provider is located in the county seat about 5 miles away, but due to transportation issues, that 5 miles is a significant barrier. the one healthcare provider in the community has done a phenomenal job to increase the services that he can provide, to expand what he's able to do, and be able to bring care to folks. But when you talk about substance abuse referrals and treatment, and some of the hepatitis C referrals, those resources simply are not there. We partnered with CDC very early in this outbreak response. We had a huge EpiAid team that deployed to Indiana in late March of 2015, including DIS, medical epidemiologists, communications specialists, database analysts. Several different programs were involved in that deployment. We had upwards of about 20 people on the ground from CDC at any one time. But another one of the aspects that they really assisted with were the phylogenetics of this outbreak. We had submitted through our laboratory specimens to the CDC laboratory for testing to determine the genetic relatedness of the HIV strain or strains among the outbreak cases. And what they found was really unusual in that almost all, I think with the exception of three, specimens from cases in this outbreak mapped to one specific genetic cluster, which is very unusual, and was an indicator that these infections had been acquired very, very recently. There had not been time for much genetic variation to develop. So presumably about 6 months prior to the first detection of cases, this infection had been introduced into the community. In contrast, in testing the hepatitis C phylogenetics, multiple strains and clusters were identified among cases, indicating that hepatitis C had been repeatedly introduced over years to decades, and some of those infections were more recent, some of them were older. I'll shift now to talk a little bit about the scope of the response, which was the largest in which I've ever participated in my public health career, and involved really an all-hands-on-deck response at federal, state, and local levels to try to control this outbreak, to determine risk factors, and then mitigate mitigation strategies to reduce transmission, ranging from epidemiology, lab testing, and medical care addiction treatment to the one-stop shop that was created to bring those services to the people who needed them because transportation, healthcare, insurance coverage were significant barriers. I'll talk more about the syringe exchange that was developed, the media and messaging and community education that were so critical to the information provision in this outbreak, and then the community capacity building, which is where we've really shifted focus today. We learned early that very few individuals had healthcare insurance and had limited access to healthcare services. So our preparedness division, in collaboration with other agencies and federal partners, created what we called a one-stop shop in Austin, right off Highway I-65 for easy access of responders coming into the area to provide HIV and hepatitis C testing, care coordination, insurance enrollment, driver's licenses, ID cards, transportation, vaccinations, whatever folks needed to be able to have an immediate response. Because again, transportation was a significant barrier. Folks didn't know where to go. Services just were not available for them. Indiana University Medical Center, located in Indianapolis, sent a team of physicians early on to assist the healthcare provider in the community to provide HIV care, assist with testing and the provision of PrEP. To address the issue of very limited HIV awareness in the community, and essentially folks did not really understand how HIV was transmitted. They were still thinking that you could get HIV by sitting next to someone, or that it was an automatic death sentence. So a lot had to be done in terms of education, of transmission of HIV, risk factors, prevention. So our communications folks, again in collaboration with federal partners, created what we called a You Are Not Alone campaign, including billboards, radio and TV spots, flyers, and I'll show you some examples of those. In Indiana, prior to this outbreak, syringe exchange was illegal by Indiana statute. In March of 2015, Governor Mike Pence enacted an executive order authorizing a limited needle exchange program in Scott County as a means to combat this outbreak and reduce transmission. The Indiana legislature enacted a new syringe exchange law on April 29th of 2015, authorizing counties to be able to enact syringe exchange programs for up to 1 year with renewal if they could show that they were seeing increased rates or outbreaks of hepatitis C or HIV. Governor Pence signed that law into effect on May 5th of 2015, and we currently have 5 Indiana counties that have active needle exchanges, and a couple are going through that renewal process and have actually completed it. Due to limited addiction treatment and referral care in the area, we partnered with our Division of Mental Health and Addiction, which is part of our Family and Social Services Administration, to increase the awareness of medically assisted therapies, training to provide Suboxone therapy, and designating a local mental health provider in the area as a federally qualified health center. Our Division of Mental Health and Addiction worked very closely with SAMHSA to bring additional resources into the area to support these efforts. And then certainly making sure that we look at how do we prevent and treat the hepatitis C infections that are also occurring. This graph is courtesy of Dr. Phil Peters at CDC, who is one of our medical and epidemiologists who served as a team lead to the EpiAid in Indiana, showing the HIV testing that was performed early on and then as the part of the big response in April and May. Testing still continues on a routine basis through the one-stop shop in Austin and through the syringe exchange and the providers in the community. What is fascinating about this response is really the continuum of care that we've been tracking with this outbreak. These numbers here, and as of June 8th, we have about 60, maybe a little over 60%, of individuals who are confirmed positive having achieved viral suppression. That is a conservative number because that number is based on the people who are actually eligible for care. If you look at the care continuum strategy, the National Care Continuum Strategy, which recommends the 90-90-90% at each of the steps in the continuum, the level of viral suppression goes up significantly, over 80% and approaching 90% in this community, and that's in 1 year. So that's a remarkable effort to achieve viral suppression in a community that maybe a year and a half ago was not even quite understanding how HIV is transmitted. So a remarkable effort there on the part of the healthcare providers and the partners to engage folks in testing and provide link to care. Communication strategies, as I mentioned, included billboards. These are a couple of examples. Some are still visible along I-65. Radio and TV spots, flyers, PSAs, public service announcements, to get the message out, to encourage people to be tested, to inform them about risk factors, inform them about treatment opportunities in an effort to reduce transmission. Scott County Health Department was instrumental in creating the first needle exchange, syringe exchange program in Indiana as an effort to combat this outbreak. It operates out of the Community Outreach Center, the one-stop shop that is still underway, as well as a mobile unit. They accept donations for needles and supplies. This is totally done at the local level through their partnerships and donations. They include ID cards and use a one-for-one plus model. They found that was what would work best in their community. What was key to making this work, though, was to get buy-in from the different partners and the different sectors within their community, including the local hospital, law enforcement, nonprofit organizations, elected officials, to really make this work. This was a brand new paradigm for Indiana. And although syringe exchanges have been operational in other locations in the country, this was new. and really was a sea change in perspective for folks to accept it and launch it and really get the message across that this will not result in more usage, but is actually a good tool to help reduce the drug usage in the community and certainly reduce disease transmission. Scott County successfully renewed their program last month. They, as per Indiana law, all of the needle exchanges, syringe exchange programs do submit quarterly data for tracking. And at the poster session, I encourage you to visit poster board 180. Erica Chapman, our HIV surveillance coordinator, prepared that. We've created a database, electronic database, to track the parameters, the data points that we need to submit for monitoring. The syringe exchange law, as I mentioned, was enacted on May 5th of 2015 and gives an outline or a procedure for counties that are considering syringe exchange as a way to reduce disease transmission in their community. As I mentioned, we have five that are currently active, with some also in that enrollment or renewal process. One of the points to considering syringe exchange, according to that law, is for local health departments, and we are a home rule state in Indiana, so this is really rooted in the local jurisdiction, is to determine if rates of hepatitis C or HIV are increasing in their communities. And to assist them, last year we created county-level data profiles for all 92 Indiana counties that include hepatitis C data, HIV data, drug overdose data, STI data, as well as who their key partners are in the community, the disease intervention specialists, the care coordinators, and others that they can contact for more information. Reporting is an issue, and hepatitis C is reported differently than HIV. And so it's very important to get data into the hands of local health departments so they can use it and know what's going on in their communities. We are expanding these profiles to include five-year trends this year to provide more information. We also are issuing what we call data report cards to local health departments each month so that they have more real-time data to see what the levels of HIV and hepatitis C are in their counties. Along with this outbreak of HIV, as I mentioned, we have a significant co-infection rate. And one of the questions we grappled with in this response was, how do we address hepatitis C, which is an indicator of unsafe injection practice and certainly HIV risk? We received some additional federal funding to enact a testing and linkage to care project in counties nearby Scott and some of that areas that have higher rates to identify those counties, provide testing kits to community health centers and providers who partner with us in this effort, and then link anyone who tests positive for hepatitis C to those local physicians and who can also receive additional consultation through Project Echo. The healthcare provider in Austin has already been enrolled in the Connecticut Project Echo now for several months. Being a family practice physician, we have some Medicaid rules that stipulate that infectious disease physicians or gastroenterologists have to prescribe hepatitis C treatment. This way, the family physicians can link to those specialists for consultation and be able to prescribe hepatitis C treatment. So we have some partnerships right now with Baylor University for any Indiana physician who wants to participate in an ECHO project. And then we are underway in Indiana at the Indiana School of Medicine, Indiana University School of Medicine, to develop a Project ECHO there in Indiana. There are also efforts underway and interest right now to develop a Project ECHO for addiction treatment and referral. Some of our ongoing recovery efforts include distributing naloxone to first responders and lay providers, and our naloxone law took effect last year as well. To decrease opioid overprescribing, increase addiction treatment services, including medically assisted therapies. So again, we're getting into some areas that I have really come to the forefront in Indiana as a result of this outbreak. Retesting and educating high-risk individuals, and then referring those negative high-risk individuals to the syringe exchange program and HIV PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. Expanding our HIV and hepatitis C testing efforts at sensitive venues, including jails, addiction referral centers, and others. Efforts have also been underway to conduct studies to gather data on additional risk factors. Qualitative studies were conducted last fall, including focus groups and interviews with people in the community who are HIV positive, to get more of a sense of what is underlying any potential risk factors in this outbreak. And then a quantitative study was conducted earlier this year, looking at case control of cases and then appropriately matched controls to identify any potential differences in risk factors as to why some folks who were injecting drugs in this network acquired HIV and others did not. Efforts are also underway to continue to evaluate the syringe exchange program and the wraparound comprehensive services that it offers. But probably most important, as we segue from response into recovery, is to develop long-term sustainable solutions to improve the public health infrastructure. But the socioeconomic disparities, the social determinants of health that really lie at the root of this outbreak. Many of you have probably seen Tom Frieden's health impact pyramid, and this really is kind of the linchpin of how this outbreak developed. We're used to working at the top when we deal with outbreaks and those specific counseling and education and clinical interventions. But what was challenging in this particular outbreak in Austin was that those bottom layers of the pyramid were largely gone. They didn't really exist. So having to build those at the same time that you're responding to an outbreak of this size and complexity was very challenging. And those are the efforts that are really being focused on now. We can get people into HIV treatment. We can treat hepatitis C. We can even treat substance abuse. But what do folks have to go back to once that's done? It's the same environment. It's the same context. It's the same trigger. So now how do we change that? That's where it's really going to take a long-term effort. And we're not done. And we're not sure when we will be done or what done will even look like. So it's going to take partnerships continuing at federal, state, and local levels to help this community essentially rebuild. And this kind of overlays our outbreak on that social determinant of health pyramid. So we have 197 HIV diagnoses. 5 deaths were identified during contact tracing due to drug overdose or bacterial infections. And I will say that since the syringe exchange program has continued in Austin, the rates of bacterial wound abscesses and endocarditis have greatly decreased. The hepatitis C viral infection has been happening for quite some time in this community. We have a network of at least 500 persons who inject drugs, and that relates back to the underlying social context within the community. Several folks have asked us, why did this happen in Austin? What is unique to Austin, Indiana, that allowed this to happen? And Austin, Indiana really is not unique. There are many other counties in the country that have some of the same issues and precursors that Austin, Indiana has. Austin, Indiana happened to be the first where an outbreak occurred, but there are many others where this could happen. And this is data that was published in Clinical Infectious Disease in 2014. You may have seen this already, but showing the expanding epidemic of acute hepatitis C infections related back to the epidemic of injection drug use compared to 2006 and 2012, that's greatly expanded. So the number of acute reported hepatitis C cases just in that 6-year time span, with the darker red being the certainly the higher incidence, has really expanded, particularly in areas of Appalachia, spreading into Indiana and even the Northeast. Also published in the MMWR back in 2015, a study conducted in Kentucky, Virginia, West Virginia, and Tennessee also indicates the dramatic increase in reported acute hepatitis C infections, with the darker blue bars being urban settings, the lighter blue bars being rural. So this is not just an urban problem, and we would have never thought that this would happen in Austin, Indiana, an extremely rural community in southeastern Indiana. But it sets the stage for what could happen in many counties across the country. CDC published last fall a vulnerability assessment that looked at counties across the country, rated on a scale based on 20 different variables or socioeconomic indicators, overdose rates, that took into context those things and then mapped, according to the country, the highest 100 and highest 200 counties that in terms of risk for an outbreak situation like this to occur. Indiana has additional counties. Certainly Austin, again, is not unique. There are many other counties and many other states that fall within that top 100 and top 200 counties for risk of something like this, an outbreak like this to happen. So it's a very good source of data to consider when you're planning, and we'll talk about some planning lessons and efforts that we've learned. First of all, rural differs from urban. So a lot of studies, a lot of resources have been focused on urban areas because of the incidence where these diseases occur. But we're seeing some new risk populations appearing as well. Injection practices, we've learned, may be different, and certainly were different in this outbreak with the repeated use of needles and the intensive needle-sharing network. There was limited knowledge of disease risk and transmission, as I mentioned. So we don't have some of the informational resources, the service resources available in the community, both monetary resources, syringe exchange programs, medical resources that might be available in more urban settings. And certainly we saw that we had reduced access to physical and mental health care services and recovery options, which are efforts that are still underway to expand. Another lesson that we learned very quickly, and folks have asked me, well, what can we do to prepare? One of the main things to do is to know your risk factors. The outbreak potential for HIV is very high in communities where hepatitis C prevalence is high because of the same type of transmission route. So reviewing the CDC vulnerability assessment data is very helpful, and it's helping us to target counties in Indiana for prevention and early intervention. That data was very useful for us. Become familiar with local data so that any increases can be easily identified before an outbreak occurs. And so having those county profiles are very helpful for our local health departments, being able to walk through data with them and really look hard at the trends that are occurring and that they may not have even distribution within a county. There may be different areas where more injection drug use is occurring or risk factors are occurring differently than in other areas of the county. Encourage healthcare providers to promptly report new hepatitis C and HIV cases, however that works in your state. We found out that early that our having two different types of reporting led to some confusion on the part of healthcare providers and how do I report and when do I report, so we had some work to do there. But follow what your state statutes say in terms of reporting and inform healthcare providers that this is very important. It's not just a state law, but it actually does something. And then look for clusters of HIV and hepatitis C. Take what the Homeland Security Department says. If you see something, say something. If the data don't look right, if you're starting to see early indicators, and there are states out here who've done this for a long time, say something. Get those partners involved and act early. preparing in advance is key. And folks have asked me, well, what could we do if something like that were to occur in our state? And the key is to prepare in advance. Identify your community partners and leadership for assistance, services, and potential response. Who would be your mental health care service providers? How can you link folks to substance abuse referral? Who can provide HIV treatment and care resources? How is that done? How could you increase hepatitis C and HIV testing in your county or in your community, in your high-risk communities? Is that already underway, or does that need to be ramped up? Consider PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, for the high-risk HIV-negative individuals. Do folks know what PrEP is? Do you have a good way to deliver it? We had to learn a lot about PrEP and educate the community about PrEP and the importance of it. Increase awareness and ability of addiction recovery services, medically assisted therapies, naloxone, that some of you may have been doing already for quite a while. But in some of these rural areas, these might be quite new or services may not be readily available. It is imperative to get input from stakeholders all across the community, from healthcare to law enforcement to elected officials to the community nonprofits, because everyone's going to play a role in prevention and certainly if an outbreak occurs in the response. And get that input, that support and buy-in in developing, if you do develop a comprehensive response that it would include a syringe exchange. In Indiana, we view that as part of a total comprehensive response to reducing transmission and providing services. If the data indicate that something may be going on, despite the preparations that you make and the partnerships that you have, be ready to escalate. 2 days after I learned of the increase in HIV cases, we activated Incident Command. That really helped us to streamline and structure and coordinate what would become a federal, state, and local response. The communication, the resources, the tasks, all of that, the data gathering that go into play. Identify your mission and goals and indicators of success. How do we know when our response is working? Are we monitoring new cases? Are we testing? How many positives are we getting? What are those indicators? DIS, disease intervention specialists, are critical to case investigations and contact tracing. I cannot speak about them enough. How many do you have in your state? Would you have enough to be able to provide enough of those capacities? Keep everyone informed. Involve local agencies from the beginning because they are going to be the ones on the ground. Monitor your resources carefully and plan your de-escalation, and at the same time, you plan your response. So in conclusion, we have an expanding epidemic of injection drug use occurring, and including a new and expanding group of residents who are highly vulnerable to HIV and hepatitis C, particularly in rural areas. Effective prevention and mitigation requires a robust combination of physical and mental health services in a wraparound approach. And sometimes those services will have to be taken directly to folks who cannot access them otherwise. This was really a health equity, social determinants of health problem that manifested as an HIV hepatitis C outbreak. And so now addressing those issues are really the next big steps in the recovery effort. There are more folks here than I can ever begin to thank, but you get an idea of the scope of the response, both at the federal, state, and local levels, and certainly thank all of them. And if I have just a minute, do I have a minute?
Yes.
Okay. I'll take one quick minute. I want to share with you some comments and perspectives from Brittany Combs, who is the one public health nurse in Scott County. She was instrumental in creating the syringe exchange and providing the services and interviewing patients and cases and really going out into her community outside her comfort zone. So I want to share with you very quickly some of the things that she learned, and this is part of her story. She says, the first thing that I like to tell people is the fact that I did not know anything about needle exchange before the outbreak. I wouldn't say I was against it, but I never had a reason to research it before because it was illegal in the state of Indiana. The first thought through my head when it was brought up was the same as many others, in that we would be enabling the users. But then we started researching needle exchanges and realized rather quickly how effective they really are, that there was a lot of research out there providing how they work and how they do not enable the drug user. We had to learn about substance abuse rather quickly also. I never really understood the complexity of substance use disorder and all it entails. I always wondered why people didn't just quit. But since working with the population and educating myself, I have learned the power that substance abuse has over the people and how strong the addiction really is. I knew that it would be really hard to get people to quit, especially since the resources that they need were not available in our community. And then she goes on to say, we have learned the hard way that people will abuse substances no matter what. We had a huge problem with Opana, and since the response has occurred, it is harder to find. Now people are going to heroin that is laced with other substances such as morphine and fentanyl. We've been fighting this problem for years, and will continue to be fighting it. That is why we have to get the services available for people to quit and support them in that long-term recovery. Then and only then will we slow the drug abuse problem within our county. So a lot was learned at many different levels, and I certainly thank all of you for your attention today and be happy to take any questions.
We have time for just one question, please, and otherwise Pam can meet you afterwards.
Okay, one question. Hi, I'm Rick Vogt from Colorado. When I was a state epidemiologist in Hawaii, I oversaw the first needle exchange program in that particular state. It was legal at the time, and still is legal. My question is this. I noticed in one of your slides that you actually distributed more needles than you returned. Did you get any pushback at that stage simply because in our state, what we found was that if you were giving out more needles than you were returning, you found that you got the elements that felt that you were actually distributing needles to enhance the problem rather than to abate the problem?
Yes, thank you for your question. And that is something that we've had to address, or that the Scott County Health Department, in working the needle exchange, has had to address. And that's why the tracking is very important. One of the concerns has been, you know, where are the needles? Are we finding them used discarded needles on the street? Where are they going? So the tracking is very important. Sometimes what happens, what we've learned, and I think what they've seen a little bit, is that there can be some secondary exchange going on. And that is going to happen to some extent. And I think providing that education and letting people, but also getting people to come directly to the exchange, it's a process. And that's something that we've had to work with as well in Scott County.
Yeah, did law enforcement give you a hard time with that particular aspect of it?
There was some concern on the part of law enforcement, local law enforcement, and that's, again, part of that process. But having them at the table at the beginning is very, very important, and they were, and they continue to be. But everyone has a little bit different perspective too, and trying to, you know, make sure that all of those are represented is key. But that's something that they're still working with down in Scott County.
Thanks very much. Executive board members, please come to the front here. Thank you. Give our speakers another hand. Thank you.